The show is called Live and Local. It's your connection to local music and more. We encourage you to go out and hear local music and introduce you to local and visiting artists. And in the case of today's program, we have all local artists, some of them performing for us live on the show. They are members of Vox Shambana, who are all together a 12-voice early music choir who are going to be giving a concert of sacred motets and masses this Thursday evening at the Chapel of St. John the Divine in Champaign. And the second portion of the program will be spent with pianist Ian Hobson, longtime distinguished professor at the University of Illinois and a world-traveled pianist. He has embarked on a series of three solo recitals paying tribute to Franz Liszt during his bicentennial year. And we'll be hearing about the remaining two recitals in that series, which are this, well, tonight and Friday night at the Krannert Center in Urbana. It's Live and Local on FM 90.9. We just heard the Kyrie Eleison, the very opening movement of the Pape Marcelli Mass, Pope Marcellus Mass, by Giovanni Pierluigi da Palestrina, performed by the Voices of Ascension, conducted by Dennis Keane here on Live and Local on FM 90.9. And that's by way of introduction to a group locally called Vox Shambana, as in Champaign Urbana. And they are all together a 12-voice choir. They specialize in early music of various types. We have six of their members here with us today, including their director, John Cox. And they're going to be giving a program on Thursday night at 7:30 in Champaign called Monuments of Sacred Music. It's going to be at this Episcopal Chapel of St. John the Divine on South Wright Street, in the midst of all the one-way streets, so it can be sort of difficult to get to, but one can get there, and it will be worth it, I'm sure, once you actually do it. A nicely varied program of sacred music, and thank you all for taking time out to come on the show today. John, it's been a while since you guys have been here, I think twice before, and I know this was a concert you were going to try to do in the fall, or at least you were going to try to do a concert in the fall. Why Monuments of Sacred Music, and how on earth did you narrow them down?
Well, you know, this would be Monuments of Sacred Music, volume 1 of 100, I would say. We started out with a program trying to mix in continental and British, British music, because the past two concerts we've done mainly English composers. So I wanted to really sample some of the low countries, some of the composers from there, and some of the Italian composers as well. So I started off with just a selection of pieces, a few mass movements, a few motets, and a hymn, which I thought worked well together. And I was selecting from what we might call the canon, the most often performed, the most popular motets and masses from the Renaissance. So that's how the idea for the concert started out. We had been working on these for quite a while now. We started out in the fall working with this repertoire, intending on a December concert, but some illness prevented us from presenting it in December, and so now we've polished it even more and are ready to go with this concert.
Even more, I like that. What do you mean by low countries? You said places from the low countries.
Well, Northern Europe, places where the Burgundian courts were in the late Middle Ages, and so what would now be Belgium and the Netherlands, Holland, those northwestern European countries.
And just for my edification, why are they called the Low Countries?
They are below sea level.
Is that it?
I believe that they are below sea level, hence the need for the dikes and dams.
Well, Holland we certainly knew about, yes.
Right, right.
Nobody will be having their fingers in any walls or anything like that during the course of this concert. So introduce the various composers. I mean, Tallis, of course, an Englishman that most people probably will have heard of. John Taverner, maybe. Mm-hmm. But the others, maybe not.
Well, Taverner is lesser known. The generation before Tallis in England, the continental composers were doing Adriano Villaert, who is maybe, I would say, in the lesser known category. He, for 30 years, was organist at San Marco, the basilica there in Venice, and made his career mainly in Italy. He's considered to be one of the first people to write for double choir music, which is a texture that was quite popular for at least 200 years after his life. But there's a theorist, Zarlino, who is a student of Villaert's, who says that Master Villaert perfected the double choir, this chori spezzati, or eight-voice music, that type of composition. The composition we're singing by Villaert is an O Magnum Mysterium setting, which the most popular O Magnum Mysterium setting seems to be by Victoria. This one is similar in nature. The first half of the piece is a setting of the mystery of the virgin birth. The second part of the motet is really an antiphon. It's a hymn in praise of the Virgin Mary, the Mother of Christ. So that's a piece by Villaert. We're also doing a motet by Josquin des Prez, who's pretty well known, I think, for Renaissance composers. This one is considered one of his masterpieces. It's quite difficult. It has double canon. It's a six-voice motet, Praeter Rerum Serium, which is essentially the translation is what a mystery or great mystery, also about the virgin birth. And
when you say double canon, that means?
It means that of the six parts, four of them operate in canon, which the canon is literally strict counterpoint, where whatever one voice has, the next voice to come in that's imitating that initial voice repeats exactly the same material that the first voice had.
So and kind of like a round.
Sure, like a round that is an exact duplication of the first. And in this motet, some of them are canon at the exact proportion. That means it's at the same speed. Sometimes they're not at the same proportion, so you'll have one voice sort of taking one measure to use a theme, and the next voice that imitates it might use three measures, so a proportion of 3-1 in between the canon voices. And then we're doing a mass, which is based on that Josquin motet by Cipriano de Rore. And that we're going to perform the Sanctus in Agnus Dei from the Missa Praeter Rerum Serium. So.
And what are we going to sample today?
Today we're going to sing the Tallis Sonata Lux, which is a very popular piece, and also the Villaert O Magnum Mysterium.
And what is the translation, at least at the beginning of the Tallis?
The Tallis is, O light, born of light, Jesus, Redeemer of the world, with loving kindness deign to receive supplicant praise and prayer. Thou who once deigned to be clothed in flesh for the sake of the lost, grant us to be members of thy blessed body. And this was actually published by Tallis and William Byrd in 1575. They were the first composers to receive a patent to publish from Queen Elizabeth I.
And what does that text come from? It's a text that others have set, I think.
It is.
But it doesn't sound biblical.
I think it's a commentary. It's a hymn text, which were often prose. So not strictly biblical.
So that somebody wrote, and we're not maybe quite sure who.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
We're going to hear six members of Vox Shambana performing in advance of their concert on the 3rd of March in Champaign. And they're on Live and Local on FM 90.9.
Dignare clemens.
for a pretty famous piece. I would have thought it had been longer than that. Onata Lux, music of Thomas Tallis, sung by members of Vox Shambana, who are director and tenor John Cox, baritone Yohei Endo, let me see if I got all these voice parts right, singing alto Ellen DeVard and Ardia Thurston Shane, and soprano Shanhui Lin, and on the bass John Wagstaff, or Wagstaff, as he's more likely to say, here on Live and Local on FM 90.9. Their concert's going to be Thursday night, on my birthday, I will have you know. Oh. It's a big one, 7:30 at the Chapel of St. John the Divine, 1011 South Wright Street in Champaign. John and anybody else who wants to chime in here, I know we touched on this one of your previous visits here. I don't remember how far we got into it, but which is the issue of vibrato. I think we were talking about whether, you know, the various arguments, when to use it, when not, and so on. But I guess I'd be interested to know how many of you, or of those of you who have a pretty easy natural vibrato, do you find it especially challenging to sing without it? And how does one do that, if you can even describe it, and so on?
Well, it's kind of possible to turn it on and off. And with this kind of music, you do try to limit the amount of vibrato you use.
Because?
Because we're looking for purity of sound, and we're looking for a kind of homogeneous sound, I suppose, where, as we said last time we visited, you don't want one voice to stand out, partly for musical reasons, and it's quite possible that for liturgical reasons, when people were performing back then, they didn't want in some way to distinguish themselves from the rest of the group. It's become a tradition that this kind of music is performed that way. We don't actually know. There may have been people performing with vibrato and quite a heavy vibrato, but we just don't know. And the tradition seems to be to perform without vibrato.
Any idea when that tradition got started?
We know from treatises in the early 17th century, mostly Italian treatises on solo singing, that vibrato was considered an ornament among, six or seven different types of ornaments that a solo singer could add to a melodic line as an embellishment. And so it's not called vibrato, it's called a tremolo, essentially, to tremble on one note. So we know that maybe as early as 1610, 1615 in Italy, that vibrato was a very common thing to use, not constantly, but to ornament longer notes of a piece. It's quite possible, as John said, that it existed before that time, although we don't have a lot of proof one way or the other that vibrato was a constant part of vocal sound. One of the things to think about is that at the end of the Renaissance, there's not a lot of, virtuosic singing going on. These are trained people in terms of they've studied theory, studied counterpoint, and they all can read music. But the way we think about being a professional singer these days is that you've taken many years of voice training that teaches you to engage the full physicality of your voice and to be able to sing over an orchestra or to fill a large room by projecting your voice. Because these people were singing in cathedrals that had really great acoustics, they didn't have to really engage their full lung capacity and diaphragm and all these things we think about. So the style of singing may have been a lot closer to what we think of as amateur singing these days in terms of this, the production of the tone. And with a lot of amateur singing, well, the range of vibrato varies quite a bit. I grew up playing the saxophone, and that instrument is an instrument where you achieve vibrato through your embouchure, through a tightening and loosening of the embouchure. So when I started to sing more and more, my approach was that of when you sing, you make a straight tone, and the vibrato is something that you physically add to it, rather than it being always there. And so I think that there are many not only physical things, but psychological things that influence whether or not a singer has a lot of vibrato.
What about one of the women here? What about as to the difficulty of singing without it versus singing with it? Is it more difficult? Do you have to think about it?
I think it's just a matter of habit. Like, if people are habitually using vibrato, it might be hard to break the habit. I've sung mostly this sort of music, so it's not... I'm in the habit of not using it, but...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no. Same for me. And depends on what kind of music you listen to as well. So if you listen to a lot of similar music, then vibrato doesn't really occur to you to use all that much.
I think Shanhui is newest to the group and has sung a lot maybe more modern music. So what's your, you know, do you feel like you really have to hold yourself back vibrato-wise, or how would you say?
For the contemporary music, I don't think I need to hold the vibrato, because for me, I don't have much vibrato. But I think the other issue is whether you are nervous or not, and the dynamic of the music. In most music, if you want to sing strong voice, you may naturally add the vibrato into it. And another interesting theory I heard, I sang the Verdi's Requiem, and the conductor asked us to sing in a very high note. He asked us to sing straight forward, but then add the vibrato. He said that will naturally create the volume of the sound, but actually it didn't do that. Mm. But the audience will feel like you create your volume of voice. Mm-hmm. So that's another interesting theory.
Well, in a way, you're almost adding pitches, you know, adding other partial pitches to the main tone, and so you're kind of adding more sound. In a way, and of course, we hear pop singers do this all the time, or jazz singers, you know, where you'll start on a note and it'd be very straight, and then it'll suddenly bloom at the end, you know, as a very deliberate sort of technique. Well, I was just curious about that. So apparently nobody here finds it particularly difficult to do, which was one thing I was curious about. Let's hear your second selection. This was, I forget which one you said it was going to be.
This is the Villaert Omanu Mysterium.
And we're doing a little bit of rearranging. You might want to recenter yourselves on the microphones there.
Okay.
And these are members of Vox Shambana on Live and Local.
Thank you.
Nicely done. Six members of Vox Shambana in music by Adriano Villaert, or you'll often see his name as Adrian. O Magnum Mysterium is the setting. That will be one of several pieces, that including parts of a mass that they're going to be doing on a concert called Monuments of Sacred Music this Thursday evening at 7:30 at the Chapel of St. John the Divine in Champaign. It's at the corner of Wright Street, and I forget what's the other street there.
Armory
Avenue, in right next to the what they call the Graduate Library on the University of Illinois campus. It's right smack in the middle of the campus. And it should be a wonderful program. The members who are with us are Shan-Hui Lin, Ellen Divard, Ardia Thurston-Shane, Yohei Endo, John Wagstaff, and the director, John Cox. Thank you all very much for coming in, and best of luck with the concert.
Thank you.
Happy birthday.
Oh, thank you much. Thank you very much, in a couple of days. Stay tuned next. We have a performance, well, not a performance, by a conversation with pianist Ian Hobson, who's going to be giving the second and third concerts of his Liszt series during this Liszt bicentennial year, tonight and Friday at the Krannert Center in Urbana. Today's programming is made possible in part by a grant from the Beckman Institute for Advanced Science and Technology Open House, Friday, March 11th and Saturday, March 12th on the U of I campus. More than 30 exhibits bring to life the research taking place at Beckman. It's live and local on FM 90.9. And we've come around back to the beginning material from Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, the opening movement in a performance by the Berlin Philharmonic, conducted by Claudio Abbado. Almost forgot who conducted that, here on Live and Local on FM 90.9. And I'll tell you in a bit why I played that music, because there was certainly a reason for it. Let me mention first that support for our broadcast today comes in part from the owners of 1015 West Church Street in Champaign, a century-old four-bedroom home on a double lot offered by Sharon Harkness of Keller Williams Realty. An open house will be held this Sunday, March 6th, from 2 to 4 p.m. More information is at sharonharkness.com.
Recently, the House of Representatives passed H.R. 1, the continuing resolution, which eliminates federal funding for public broadcasting. Now the Senate will draft its version. It makes a difference when your senators hear from you that funding for public broadcasting is important. Contact information is at will.illinois.edu. Stay informed at 170millionamericans.org. Thanks.
My next guest on Live and Local is Ian Hobson, who is a well-renowned pianist throughout the world, and, of course, especially here in our area, since he is a longtime professor at the University of Illinois, professor of piano, also conducts Sinfonia da Camera, and actually approaching retirement, though I won't say approaching retirement age. And he is going to be giving the second and third concerts, which are the two remaining concerts, in his Liszt series. He did the first one a week or so ago, and the next is tonight at 7:30, and then finally on Friday at 7:30, both of those in the Follinger Great Hall of the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts in Urbana. Thanks, Ian, for joining us.
Very nice to be here.
So the Liszt bicentennial year. I would venture to say that of Franz Liszt's music overall, there's maybe two or three pieces that are really well known, maybe four or five. And they don't include too many of the solo piano pieces, except for some of the quieter ones.
Well, you know, he wrote many more transcriptions of other people's music than he wrote original compositions, and including Beethoven, Wagner, you know, Mozart operas, paraphrases, Verdi, Saint-Saëns, everything you can think of. Berlioz, Symphonie Fantastique, Harold in Italy, he transcribed those for piano. And he was probably universally recognized as the greatest pianist ever, although we'll never be able to ascertain that completely because there are no recordings of his work. But from the complexity and the quality of his writing for the piano and his skill as a transcriber, he was obviously a phenomenal pianist. He was also a great conductor, and he helped people out. He was very much an advocate of his contemporaries like Schumann and Berlioz and Chopin. And he was much more generous about their music than they were about his.
And is it the fact that he wrote all of these transcriptions of other people's music, was that largely because he was primarily a performing pianist and he wanted to bring in things that were popular to his recitals?
Yes. He wrote during the 1830s, late 1830s, was really the last time that he performed in public, and he was performing all the time music of other composers, Beethoven and Chopin particularly. And he wrote the second version of his Transcendental Etudes, which is the one that I'm going to play, known as the 12 Grand Etudes, at that time when he was a virtuoso. And it's actually interesting about those 12 etudes. He wrote the first version when he was about 15. And yet musically, it's all there. That is the basis, thematically and structurally, for what came later. Then came the second version, which is during his virtuoso period, 1837. And then the version of the Transcendental Etudes that we know best is from 1851, which was after he'd stopped performing publicly. And he basically simplified the second version. He simplified it so that other people, mortals, lesser mortals, could play this stuff. But I like the second version very much. It is complicated. It's a little cluttered.
Cluttered in what way?
I mean, there's so many notes. And it's so difficult to play. But the grand gestures of composition are there. It's very powerful. It's almost symphonic for the piano.
I think we're going to hear a selection from these 12 grand etudes, they were called in this version.
Yeah. And this is number 10, I think, you're going to play, which is the F minor, which is fairly well known in the third version. And this one is so complicated. It's got so many rhythmical twists and turns and a different kind of coda than the familiar one has. Busoni, who edited all of this stuff and was a great pianist in his own right, said that this is probably the one which is just too complicated of the second version group. Busoni actually preferred the second version group, but this one, he said, is a little bit over the top.
So he likes his things complicated, maybe.
Yeah.
Here's pianist Leslie Howard. Is this somebody you know?
Yes, Leslie Howard is an Australian pianist who has the distinction of being the only person to record the complete works of Liszt.
There are many, many discs.
Oh, at least 60, I would think.
Yeah, there's a lot. And we've got a lot of them, but not all of them. Leslie Howard here, Music of Liszt on Live and Local. Was a performance by Leslie Howard of the 10th of the 12 Grand Etudes of Franz Liszt. And you can hear all 12 of them played by Ian Hobson tonight at 7:30 at the Krannert Center in Urbana, along with 12 etudes of Frédéric Chopin. So, and Ian is with us on Live and Local here, this portion of the show. So the Chopin is the only set of pieces that are not by Liszt on these programs, or that Liszt doesn't have a hand in, or is this his version of these etudes?
No. This is by Chopin and dedicated to the Countess Marie d'Agoult, who was Liszt's mistress at the time.
I figured there had to be a connection.
And also, it is a set that very much influenced Liszt in his rendering of his own etudes, which were, you know, a couple of years later. Liszt had great reverence for Chopin's ability to write great music in the form of etudes. And so I think it had a tremendous influence on him. In the other programs, you're right, Liszt has a hand in everything, but there is Paganini and there's Beethoven. And so I call the third program, which is Friday's program, Heroes, because Paganini was the real spur to Liszt when he heard Paganini play on the violin. He wanted to do that on the piano. He wanted to be able to write staggeringly scintillating and difficult music on the piano as Paganini did for the violin. And so he chose these six etudes, five of which are based on caprices of Paganini, and the sixth is based on La Campanella, which is a concerto, violin concerto of Paganini.
So on the theme of that.
On the theme, yeah.
On one of the movements.
And in this 1838 version, we have more themes than just the one that we know, the bell theme. More themes from that concerto appear in this etude.
So in the later version of the etudes, it's actually nicknamed La Campanella. The first set, it doesn't even carry
that
name.
Yes, I think that's right. He does call it La Campanella.
In the early version?
In the first version also, yeah.
Then Leslie Howard just didn't put that on this particular CD. We're going to hear Leslie Howard again in that third etude from the Paganini tribute pieces of Franz Liszt, and these will be played in their entirety on Friday night's recital by Ian Hobson, and you're hearing them on Live and Local. That's the third of the first version of the Paganini Etudes by Franz Liszt in a performance by Leslie Howard here on Live and Local, and you can hear Ian Hobson play all of those etudes on Friday night at 7:30 at the Krannert Center. He's giving a recital tonight also at 7:30, a program called, simply Studies. There are etudes by Chopin and 12 grand etudes of Liszt tonight. And then besides the Paganini etudes on Friday, we come round to the reason that I introduced Ian Hobson with Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. And that is because he's going to end this series with Liszt's transcription of the complete Fifth Symphony of Beethoven. So this is sort of almost the ultimate example, or ultimate tribute, I suppose, of Liszt to another composer, where he basically doesn't change a word.
That's right. He does it so skillfully, and he doesn't add a harmony. He doesn't mess around with the music. He translates it to pianistic language. And he did that for all of the Beethoven symphonies. He did it in the mid-60s, 1860s, when he'd stopped performing in public. And so, in a sense, he was doing a service to musicians and music lovers who wouldn't have the opportunity to hear Beethoven symphonies in the concert hall. And so he could bring that music to them personally, if you like, if they could make their way through it playing it, or they could hear somebody like Liszt performing it. The fifth is, of course, the most famous, and it's the one that's been recorded by several people. The first performance I heard of it was Glenn Gould, and I think that he did it in a multi-track way. That is, he recorded some of it and then superimposed other layers. And I know that he did that with the Meistersinger Prelude in the studio. So it's fascinatingly clean and brilliant in a way, in the way that he does it. Maybe it's not so natural. Now more people have tackled these works. But I played it in concert a long time ago in London, and people really appreciate the clarity of the part writing and this kind of thing. They said, several people said, you know, I never heard that in the orchestral version. And even with great concert halls and great orchestras, there's so much to listen to. And when you hear it on the piano, it really clarifies things.
Makes
it different. Yeah.
And as a pianist, when you're in control of your own fingers, so you can bring out some things maybe a little more easily than an orchestra can.
Right. There is that. But it's a big challenge because there's lots of notes to play.
Well, you said he wrote these, he did these after he retired from the stage. Does that mean that he made them a little easier than, or a little less complex than he might have made them had he done it?
I don't think so in this case, no. The kind of transcriptions that he was doing when he was a performing virtuoso, such as the paraphrases of Don Juan, Don Giovanni, Mozart, Wagner, Tannhäuser Overture, this kind of thing, were filled with cadenzas and opportunities for pianistic display. The Beethoven is not, but it's very difficult still to play all the notes that Beethoven wrote for the orchestra. And I suppose that, you know, in Weimar, Liszt was playing for his students and for, you know, hangers-on, well-wishers and members of the public, even though it might have been a smaller public than when he was traveling around the world.
Well, you can hear Ian Hobson have a go at Beethoven's Fifth Symphony in Franz Liszt's transcription Friday night at 7:30, and the recital also tonight at 7:30 with music of Chopin and Liszt for the Franz Liszt Bicentenary. All these at the Krannert Center in Urbana. Ian, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.